Justice Berger, Chief Justice Steele, and Justice Jacobs, may it please the court. Thomas C. Marconi, Esquire, counsel for the appellants Robert Gazzetta and Kathleen Gazzetta. We have reserved 5 minutes for our rebuttal. The reason we're here is we think that the Court of Chancery misapplied Rule 65 when it refused to increase the security that was required to be posted on an injunction bond, on an injunction that was entered by the court back in May of 2007 and then subsequently renewed later in June. When we originally asked for the bond, we showed damages to the court by a written letter from a contractor that demolition charges would be increased and other charges would be increased to the amount of $8,000, and also that we would have to pay property taxes on this lot that's the subject of all this, because the things that we weren't allowed to remove would remain, and that amount was something like $2,000. So we were approximately $10,000 in damages at the very beginning of this thing when we were not allowed to remove the house and the landscaping on the property. The judge said $5,000 is the bond. There was no real reason why, how he came up with that amount. We didn't protest it at the time because, frankly, we thought that this case would be over a lot sooner than it was. We had a preliminary injunction hearing that was already scheduled, and we were going to proceed under Section 348 of Title 10. We thought it was going to be fast. Well, it wasn't. And about 17 months after the injunction was in place, when we got an order out of the master that led us to believe that we had a chance to actually prevail in this case, and we looked at the damages that we were had incurred already, we asked the court to increase the damages by filing a petition to increase the security. And with that petition, we attached a sort of a spreadsheet as an Exhibit A, and that's in our appendix, that laid out the categories of damages. There was increases in the costs to demolish the property, increases in costs to remove the landscaping, because it had been 17 months or so. And that was during the time when gas was going up. It was up to like $4 a gallon. Other things were up. Diesel was up. And so, you know, that seemed pretty reasonable to us. Also, we informed the court that the county taxes are based on the improvements and the land. And when the improvements are there, whether they're basically ready to be demolished and not being lived in or not, you have to pay your taxes on the improvements. So those came to about $18,000, plus we had an estimate for loss of use. So taxes, insurance, and loss of use came to about $18,000.
Excuse me, what loss of use?
Well, what happened was we purchased the property so that we could level. The Gazettas live next door to this house. They have a really very small backyard. This house is perfect for a yard for their kids. They had two kids at the time that I think were 10 and 12, around that age. And what we wanted to do, this is a pretty heavily wooded lot, we wanted to take down the house and the garage, take down the big trees, and level it all out and plant grass and just have a place where they could play soccer and baseball and whatever they wanted to play. Well, because of this injunction, the trees are there, the house is there, and in terms of the reason why we bought this property, it had no use to us. It was a burden. We had to just cut the grass and pick up the sticks, and we couldn't use it.
But what is the cost that was incurred for loss of use?
Well, we put the I think, Your Honor, the amount that we put is approximately $6,400, and that was up for the 17 months, and that was based on an opinion that Mr. Gazzetta got from a realtor who said that a play field like that next to a house had a value of approximately $500. So that's how we came up with that number. And the court recognized in the opinion that it wrote on our motion to increase the security that there was some value to having loss of use. It just didn't apparently agree that it was what we said it was. The basis for that, I I don't know. But so what happened was that we believed that we needed to get this increase because we were aware of the judgment injunction bond rule, I mean. And the injunction bond rule is pretty strict and it's pretty clear. And it says that if you don't get damages that aren't covered by the bond. So we calculated $79,000 worth of damages, and it was landscaping. We had to hire a landscaper, an arborist. As I said earlier, the taxes, the insurance, the loss of use, that was $18,000 total. Increased cost to demolish the trees and the house, the buildings, the garage. That was $8,500, and that was supported by a letter from the company that was going to do it. It was going to do both, the companies. And then we had the thing I don't think the vice chancellor liked very much was we had $46,000 in time off from work. But Mr. Gazzetta works like I do. There's only so much time in the day. He's a risk management consultant. He has clients that engage him. He bills them. And if he's dealing with arborists to renegotiate, hey, can we not do the demolition in July 2007? Can we do it in perhaps October 2008? That takes time. Same thing with the demolition contractor. Same thing with contacting the county and trying to figure out.
One of the issues that I've had difficulty coming to grips with here is the discussion in the briefs about what constitutes time spent in response to the request for injunctive relief and time simply spent on the underlying litigation. I don't get the difference in the concept there. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I don't think you're entitled to time spent on the litigation. I don't think Rule 65 says you are. I don't think any of the cases that talk about Rule 65C say you are. No,
well,
if you get sued.
The distinguishing factor that I'm having trouble with is if you're meeting with the arborist or the landscape expert or the demolition expert in order to determine what the increased cost might be resulting from the improvidently granted injunction, isn't that spent determining the damages that could be obtained through the underlying litigation, or is it extra time spent because of the delay caused by the injunction being in place for so long? I'm having difficulty making that a meaningful distinction between the two.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, and that's not an easy thing to do, especially when you're not given an opportunity for a hearing. But there is a distinction, because if you've already negotiated the cost of the removal of that house with that demolition contractor, and you've already negotiated and agreed on the cost to remove those trees with the tree removal company, and now they said we're going to charge you $500 and we're going to do it next Tuesday, and then all of a sudden on Monday there's an injunction and you can't do it the way you planned. If you have to take time to redo all those things, I think that's related to the injunction, because if there weren't an injunction, if there was just a lawsuit, say they said go ahead, take down the house and the trees and you know, we'll get money damages.
The reason I ask the question is I get the impression from the briefs and from the record that the vice chancellor looked at that and attributed all that time spent to being involved in litigation and basically discounted all of it on the face of it.
There's no question about that, Your Honor.
So he evidently had difficulty making the distinction, just as I'm having difficulty making the distinction, and that's why I asked for some help.
Well, Your Honor, he had something that you don't. He had the opportunity to allow us to come in and explain it to him, and he didn't. That's what we think was wrong.
Let's pursue that.
You mean you wanted a hearing?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
I want to pursue that because I'm not quite sure what did happen. You did file a formal motion to increase the amount of the bond.
Yes.
And in connection with that, you submitted at least one document or a set of documents, including a spreadsheet and letters from contractors. Is that right?
Well, we submitted one exhibit that was a spreadsheet, but on the record was a letter from a contractor in the earlier application.
Okay, there were documents submitted.
Yes.
Were briefs filed?
Not briefs, just sort of the speaking motions where you just number the paragraphs, and no briefs were asked for. No, so no briefs were filed. Argument and case law was cited.
So the record before the Vice Chancellor were your motion with the attachments, with the documentary attachments, and what did the other side file?
Just the same thing.
A letter of opposition?
Yes, I don't think they had any exhibits to their submission.
Okay.
Or any challenges to ours.
Okay, so the amount of the motion or the decision on the motion to increase the amount of the bond was made on that record?
Correct.
Was there in your moving papers a request for a live hearing? Or?
Not in the original moving papers, Your Honor. We did not ask for a hearing at that time. However, when we got the denial.
Nobody said to the Vice Chancellor, you need to hear us. You need to have us come before you in order to decide this motion.
Well, not at that stage, but when we got the denial.
Right. After on re-argument, you made the
request.
That position.
Yeah.
So basically, your position or your argument is that there was no error in not having a hearing at the time the motion was submitted and the record was made, and then the motion was denied. The error was in not granting a hearing after all that on re-argument.
I would agree with the latter, not the former. I think that the cases and the other authorities, the Emerald Partners case for one, doesn't say that I have to request a hearing. I think the judge,
you're saying the judge erred by not having a hearing sua sponte when nobody asked him to have one?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if he wasn't satisfied that we had met the appropriate level of proof with the submissions that were on the record, given the harsh effect of the injunction bond rule, I think, and the requirements of Rule 65C that say that the court has to set the bond at the level where it may, that'll cover the damages that we may
incur. My question is your position that the judge abused his discretion by not sua sponte granting or ordering a hearing before deciding the motion to enlarge the bond?
Yes. Rule 65C, there's a case out of the New York Federal Court from 1998, I think it's called Interlink International. What that says is that Rule 65C mandates that you set the security at a level, given the injunction bond rule, at a level where you think the damages may go to. I think the way we should analyze this in terms of whether it's an error of law, whether it's a misinterpretation of Rule 65C that gives rise to a de novo review or just a mere abuse of discretion, is I think the court has the discretion to look at the situation and say, there's no damages here. I'm not going to set any bond. And if that's the reasonable discretion, then that's going to stand even if it's wrong. But I think once you determine under Rule 65C that there's going to be damages, then you have to make the damages determination, the amount of the damages, fit the rule. And the rule says you've got to set them at a point where they may go to, not where they will go to. And that's what I think the Vice Chancellor did here. Some of the damages, he said, you haven't shown proximate cause. Well, proximate cause isn't anywhere near may. So I think that was error.
Let me interrupt for a second. Assuming that the Vice Chancellor set the bond at $100,000, which is more than what you're claiming, right?
Correct.
what would the result be in terms of how much you would recover?
Once the memorandum opinion came out in December of 2009, we would, or at some time other than that that the court wanted, we would schedule and hold an actual damages hearing on the matter. That's what happened in the Chancery Court did in the Emerald Partners case. The thing was over. There was a bond set, and there was a hearing was held on the damages.
At which point the judge could say, you know, I'm not allowing these $46,000 in time off from work because I don't consider that a damage that's associated with this case.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And even if I understand the numbers, even if you wrote off the $46,000, discounted it entirely as not being proximately caused by an injunction improvidently granted, there's still more than $10,000 in damages.
In round numbers, Your Honor, about, I think, around $30,000 more, something like that.
You make much in your brief about the Vice Chancellor's comment that there were at least $10,000 in damages. Well, why did he use that phrase, at least $10,000, and then set the bond at $10,000? Any indication in the record? Any indication because of argument?
Not that I can think of, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think he just made a simple mistake.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I do.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Cross on behalf of the Service Corporation of Westover Hills, the appellee in this matter. As an initial matter, and I'll be brief on this, it's the appellee's initial position that the notice of appeal or that what the appellant is now trying to appeal goes beyond the scope that was put in the notice of appeal. And this is more than a technical defect in the notice of appeal. It's not a typographical error or something like that. We believe what the appellant has done is attempted to broaden the scope of the appeal from what they initially filed. Here, the appellants appealed solely the final judgment in the case and specifically said they were appealing, quote, to the extent the court limited the damage award to $10,000, close quote. They didn't identify, for example, the order from the court setting the bond at $10,000. They didn't identify that they were appealing from the denial on the motion for reargument. And so we believe, or at least I think had an initial understanding that what they were arguing was a question about whether the injunction bond rule would limit them to the $10,000 in the bond that was originally set.
But aren't those really subsumed within the final order?
Well, we don't believe it is. I mean, the fact that that the final order makes reference to the fact that it incorporates it doesn't mean, as I understood the court's final order, it said it was limited to $10,000 because of the court's prior rulings and it incorporated those. But for the appellant, we believe it was necessary for them to identify those orders if they were truly appealing them.
Now, what's the prejudice to you in this? And the reason I ask that question is you knew from all the proceedings in Chancery that there wasn't a real argument about whether or not damages were limited to the amount of the bond. The argument was whether or not the Vice Chancellor had set the bond correctly in light of the damages that were provable or may be provable at some stage of the proceedings. Wasn't that the discussion and the argument all along?
Certainly, we don't dispute that the appellant wanted to see the bond amount raised, if that's what the court is asking. We certainly understood that they had a question about that.
And you understood why they wanted it raised.
Yes, we did. And I'm not arguing that. My point is I believe that essentially as a bright line rule, if you want to appeal the order setting the bond or the order on the motion for reargument, you need to identify those in your appeal. And the failure to do so, there's a difference between a technical defect, which the court may overlook, and broadening
that.
The scope.
I understand that. But notice of appeal is to put you on notice about what's really an issue, correct?
Correct.
Is there any question about whether you knew what was an issue or not? Any genuine question about that?
I think it was vague at best by the appellant because I think
I'll take that as an answer somewhere between yes or no.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I think a fair reading of it was they were appealing the injunction bond rule because I think a fair reading was they felt they had lost on getting the bond increased, and now we're going to attack it from another angle, which was we're not limited to $10,000 because our damages were in excess of it.
In which case they would be making an argument on appeal that they did not make in front of the trial court, right?
Correct.
Which would have different problems.
I don't disagree. But if I said I wanted to be brief on that because I think it's important to make that record that we believe that it's beyond the scope. But getting to the issue itself about whether the court erred, we do not believe there was any error in the court's decision. There was no abuse.
Before you get into that, and of course we want to hear it, has your side, has anyone done a search of the jurisprudence in the federal courts on the procedure that is supposed to be followed on motions of this kind to enlarge the amount of an injunction bond? I mean, our Rule 65 is based on the federal rule, it would just seem that there, at first blush, there ought to be a lot more authority out there than what's cited in the brief. What's cited in the brief, I believe, is one federal district court case from Wisconsin and a Southern District of New York case, and that's all.
The focus of our research was was primarily on Delaware law and not on federal law. I mean, if the court asks us to supplement the briefs, I'm certainly happy to do that.
Would you agree that one of the issues that's implicated, at least by the merits of this appeal, is what is a trial court supposed to do when confronted with a motion of this kind, that is, from a procedural standpoint?
In terms of when the court was asked to enlarge the bond?
Correct. What is the mandated motion practice?
Well, my understanding is that the court, in this case, applied the proper legal standard to it. And it's set forth, I think, fairly succinctly in the Petty versus Pentec Papers case, which said that for a substantial bond to be required, it should be supported by either facts of record or by some realistic, as opposed to yet unproven, legal theory. In this case, what the appellants sought to do was essentially submit a summary of what they believed their damages were without facts of record to support most of them, and then cited case law, which...
Without an affidavit.
I don't recall if there was an affidavit. If there was, it certainly didn't provide detail as to the basis that I can recall. And so there wasn't a sufficient factual record, and the legal basis...
Well, but let's stop here for a minute. My understanding was that the documents were attached to the motion to enlarge the amount of the bond, but they weren't verified.
I believe it was a letter that was attached, and it was not a verified
But there was not in a spreadsheet.
That's correct. And so in that situation, they had not provided sufficient factual background. But then, and I agree with Mr. Marconi when he says, I think the court focused to some extent on this issue about lost time from work. And the legal theory by which the appellant was seeking that was the Emerald Partners case, which was distinguishable, and at least when the court analyzed it, I think the court's analysis was Emerald Partners dealt with a situation where a merger was stopped and a corporation's officers were required to spend a significant amount of time as a result of the direct proximate result of the injunction dealing with the fact that the merger had been stopped. And then when it was later found that was improvident, they were entitled to those damages because they were proximately caused by the injunction. Here, the court's analysis was you're just asking for time off because you had to spend time in litigation, which any party has to do when they're in litigation. It did not, certainly if the appellant's position was otherwise, that it wasn't, you know, that it was something more than just the time having to spend in the litigation. They didn't. They certainly didn't make that a clear factual record for the court.
If we took the $44,000 to $46,000, whatever the number was, out of play, for the reason that you just explained, assuming that there is no other reasonable way to construe that number other than the way you construed it, how many dollars are we talking about?
I think it was about $32,000 that's left.
Then why a $10,000 bond?
As I understand the court's decision, the court was agreeing that they were entitled to increased taxes, and I believe it was the demolition costs that might have been increased over it. But the court discounted the idea of lost use of the property, of the and of the time off from work primarily. And I think this is important as well, as I heard Mr. Marconi's initial.
You say that, but help me with the number.
Yeah.
The number we've been dealing with. Is it more or less than $10,000?
Well, if we take out. The spreadsheet included items like landscape architect and certified arborist. It included the tree service, and it included other items which the court understood to be litigation-related items as opposed to damages resulting proximately from.
Now,
so if you took those out.
Yeah, but without an explanation, how does the court reach the conclusion that there's a distinction that can be made between litigation-related expense and an increase in it by way of inflation or increased cost because of the incredible delay in getting an opinion out in the first instance, 10 months to get an opinion out? Those costs logically at that time of life would be going up over the course of 10 months to a year. How does he just automatically conclude that that's a litigation expense and not an increase to do the work that the injunction blocked?
The appellant has a burden of creating a factual record for the court. And if the initial bond was set at $5,000.
All right, well, let's explore that burden. Was the burden beyond establishing potential damages because they appear to be reasonable or there is a theoretical legal basis for them, or must the person who's moving to increase the bond establish them as a matter of fact right then and there by affidavit or otherwise?
Well, it certainly has to be a sufficient factual record, in our opinion. It has to be more than just a statement that I incurred costs and my costs were X.
So you can't draw reasonable inferences from your life experience from what's been presented to you?
No, the court certainly can draw reasonable inferences.
Well, why isn't a reasonable inference that taking the $46,000 out because you don't think there's a legal theory to support that, whether it's proximate cause or whether it's relationship to litigation versus injunctive relief, looking at the others and seeing that that could go either way on the balance of the damages, and the balance of those damages are clearly more than $10,000. And then you use the phrase in your ruling that the damages are, quote, at least, close quote, $10,000. Put that together for me in a way that discounts, as a matter of fairness in a court of equity, saying we'll have no hearing on damages. I'm just going to say, ipsy dixit, $10,000, that's it. Move on.
First of all, I think when the court increased the bond, and this goes to this, your question, when the court increased the bond from $5,000 to $10,000, as I understood that they had not challenged the initial decision of $5,000. They didn't ask for re-argument. So presumably they were satisfied with that. And as Mr. Marconi said, the damages there were totaling something in the neighborhood of, in their opinion, $10,000. They then asked for the increase later. And so whatever the $5,000 bond covered initially wasn't really an issue. It was whatever they added on to later.
One of the reasons $5,000 might have been satisfactory in the beginning is no one had any conception that it was going to take the Court of Chancery 10 months to render an opinion in a case no more complex than this one. But it did, better or worse. And that generated the idea that $5,000 wouldn't be enough, and then the argument that $10,000 was arbitrarily set.
Well, and so The appellant then submitted their motion to increase the bond to $10,000 or to well above $10,000, and the court set it at $10,000. And they provided essentially a summary in terms of the factual basis for it, saying we had these costs without really any sufficient detail as to how to break that down or why they're approximately being caused by the injunction. They then used what we believe was not a realistic legal theory, as the Petty versus Pentec case calls for. They used an unproven legal theory. And then when the court...
What was that unproven legal theory, or why wasn't the theory that could support that by inference reasonable?
Well, primarily, again, it goes back to the idea that you had lost time from work. And so...
Well, we've been there.
Okay.
And I said, let's take the $46,000 out. You still have a number that's substantially higher than $10,000.
$32,000.
Correct. And that goes to the lost use of the property. And again, it doesn't appear that they provided any real legal authority for that lost use of the property. What they're not saying they actually incurred damages. They're saying they simply didn't get to use the property to the extent they would have liked. But it's not that they lost income. It's not that they had to spend money as a result that totaled this $8,500 claim. They're simply saying our loss of enjoyment of it.
Okay, my bad's not that good. Let's take $8,500 from $32,000. I still get more than $10,000.
I don't disagree. And then you have the increased or the cost for landscape architect and certified arborist that gets you up. That's another $3,000 that appeared to be related to litigation as opposed to the injunction being granted.
Great. Explain that to me. Why is that related to litigation and not a direct result of the improvidently granted injunction? Because the work couldn't be done sooner, had to be done later as expenses rose.
No, as what I at least had understood, or I'm sorry, what the appellees had understood that those costs were related to at the time was during the course of litigation, each side was hiring architects and landscape architects and arborists to discuss how trees could be removed, what kind of landscaping might be put in place in order to settle the case, things like that, as opposed to maintaining the property during the time of the injunction. There were costs associated with litigation in terms of trying to come up with plans to resolve the case.
I didn't understand it to be maintaining the property. I thought what they wanted to do was to remove trees and remove buildings, and that if you delayed it because being able to do those two acts, because of an injunctive relief barring you from doing so, the ultimate cost of demolishing two structures and removing trees went up. Is that not a fair inference? And is that not more than $10,000?
Certainly that was not our understanding as the reason for them asking for that. I suppose it's an inference that could be made, but it's not the inference that certainly the appellees had made at the time, and I don't think it's the one that the court made. The court, I think, had understood those costs related to the litigation as opposed to the injunction.
Well, on what basis did the court reach that understanding, given that there was no hearing? And basically all that the court had was a motion with documents and, I guess, a letter from your side.
Well, I think the court was aware. The court was certainly aware that the parties had been in settlement discussions and had been attempting to resolve it through an agreed-upon landscaping design.
Well, is the awareness based on anything of record?
There were documents submitted to the court trying to enforce a settlement agreement that we believed had been put into place. In addition, at one point, the appellants had indicated they were going to start cutting down trees that they believed needed to be cut down for health reasons, you know, because of the health of the trees. And we had opposed that at the time.
If the cost of the arborist and the demolition experts could go up over time, and a reasonable inference could be that that's as a result of injunctive relief being granted, but an equally reasonable inference would be that the parties were negotiating the way in which the demolition would take place and the way in which the landscape would be left, so perhaps it would satisfy the restrictive covenants of the association or whatever the right terminology may be. Two reasonable inferences. Mm-hmm. How does a court normally resolve facts that could be construed inappositely but reasonably either way. Isn't that normally done as a result of an evidentiary hearing?
There could be an evidentiary hearing.
And but why wasn't there one here?
I think the court determined that there was no need for it because the moving party had failed to satisfy their initial burden. And if I can get back to the I think where the court was struggling was this idea that you could prove at least the $10,000.
Now, which court's struggling? You mean that
this court is not struggling in any regard. I don't mean
I'll concede this court is struggling, but if you're talking, I just want to get clear in my brain which court's struggling at the moment in your mind.
Your Honor, to the extent that the lower court said that damages could be proven at least $10,000, and I think this court is asking, well, then wouldn't that necessarily mean that maybe the court should have thought about a higher bond in the first place if at the end of the day it acknowledged that damages may have been higher?
Well, Ms. Cross, as a result of the questions that Chief Justice asked, I think we backed out of the equation. You know, all of the items that arguably don't have a proper theoretical basis, and we're down to the ones that do have it.
Right.
I gather then that your position is that the evidentiary burden as to those items wasn't met. And the question I have is, what exactly is that burden? Your argument is that there has to be more than just unverified documents that are sent over to the court.
Certainly, I think there has to be more than unverified documents sent to the court.
Does the burden require the party seeking to enlarge the bond to make a summary judgment type record?
Well, it would certainly, and my time is up if I can finish, the party would certainly have to supplement or provide to the court some evidence upon which the court could conclude that those damages could likely occur.
But is the quantum of evidence somewhere between unverified documents and a full summary judgment record? Or in that Netherland?
Well, no. I think they would have to be facts. They have to be facts that can be submitted as evidence to the court. It does have to be more than unverified facts. But if I could make one point to conclude about this issue about the damages being over the $10,000. The initial bond was set at $5,000. After the appellant had submitted a list of damages, including the $8,000 increased demolition costs and taxes, the court concluded that they had only proven damages that would allow them to get a bond of $5,000. They never appealed that. So the initial bond of $5,000 covered all of those damages. The increased damages, when you discount the loss of use of the property and the lost earnings and the arborist and the architect, as I understood it, didn't exceed the initial $10,000. And so the court at the end said, look, I agree the damages could be proven more than $10,000, perhaps because the initial damages for which you had limited it to $5,000 might be in excess of it. But the fact that they chose not to appeal that initial determination cuts off those initial damages for which they were trying to get a bond.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So just very quickly, I just wanted to follow up, I think, on a couple of questions that Justice Jacobs asked. In my experience and in my reading of the rules, there is no procedure that's set or rule that addresses what the vice chancellor is supposed to do with a hearing or an application like the one that we submitted in the form of the petition to increase.
Clearly, it's not written in the text of the rule itself. But are you aware of any teaching on the federal level of what the practice, the procedure should be?
No, Your Honor, but I do have experience, not a whole lot, certainly much less than some, in what we actually do here. And it's the same thing that we actually did in May of 2007. An application is made. I've heard it done over the telephone at a very preliminary stage, at a TRO stage. I've heard it at a preliminary injunction stage. But what we did here is what I've always seen us do. And that is, you say, may we have a bond in this amount? And seems like, again, in my experience, that the vice chancellor just sets it. And so that's what we did with the petition to increase it. We asked for it. We gave some facts, put them on the record that, you know, they weren't verified, obviously. But everything, in my experience, again, it's sometimes done over the phone. It's based on what the lawyer said. And so that's what we did. And I also wanted to note that in the order denying the petition to increase the security, the vice chancellor didn't say anything like, well, it's really a shame, but we don't have an affidavit to support these facts, so I'm not going to believe them. He didn't say that. He said, you know, he looked at it and took them as true and concluded that they weren't worthy of belief. And so I don't think that the fact that there wasn't any kind of verification on the record or the facts were somehow not formally on the record or sufficiently on the record, I don't think
so. The way you read the opinion is that the court, despite the non-verification of the facts, nonetheless treated them as if they were verified and then went on to hold that the facts, even, you know, when viewed that way, were not legally sufficient to grant you an increase of above $10,000.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.